Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back for News, Trends, and Stories Part 2 with Dr. Joseph Farrell. We had a great and juicy conversation last week about economy and financial markets and geopolitics. We went through the long-term trends in Trump's report card. I hope you've listened to it. And we're back today to talk about the other sections. You can find them on the web presentation at News, Trends, and Story. It'll link from your commentary, the commentary on the website for this second quarter wrap-up News, Trends, and Stories Part 2. We're going to be discussing culture, science and technology, go local, unanswered questions, and inspiration. Dr. Joseph Farrell, the perfect person on the whole planet to talk about culture.
Yeah, I grew up with a lot of that in South Dakota.
Yeah, how'd you get all that culture in South Dakota? Wow. Okay, well, tell us a little bit about what you think was important in the second quarter about culture.
Oh, golly, where do we start? It's a difficult thing to answer. You know, last week I pointed out that magazine that I subscribe to, Fine Art Connoisseur, and the fact that they had this article about Chinese art schools teaching the traditional craft of visual arts from
right.
ground up, from drawing up. That was a very encouraging sign to me in one respect. But I think the biggest cultural news last quarter has to be the Vatican for a number of reasons. You know, the Roman Church is very entwined with our Western culture, and for good and ill, a lot of it good, a lot of it bad. But we saw this very weird story that began with Pope Francis dismissing Cardinal Pell from his position at the Vatican Bank to answer charges that have been brought against him in Australia.
Right.
And as the week unfolded, then we heard stories that were first, I think it was first broken in the United States on Alex Jones, and then just went viral very quickly from that point, of some sort of, I don't know, satanic, Luciferian sex orgy thing being held at an apartment of someone who allegedly is a top advisor to the Pope. And then we had the dismissal of Cardinal Miller, I believe it was, by the Pope. And to me, culturally, Catherine, what this signals is I think you're watching the ongoing regime change operation that was launched by Hillary and Obama in the last years of his administration against the Vatican. I think the retirement of Benedict XVI was part of this. I think bringing in Francis was part of this. And this, you know, Francis began well. He made the steps to start trying to clean out the Vatican Bank. This now appears to have been sidelined with this pedophilia sex orgy scandal thing. I think the target here was really someone does not want any changes in the way that the Vatican Bank operates.
Right.
And so they've gone after these cardinals. The one that's interesting to me is Miller, because the problem here is it appears to me that somebody wants the last vestiges of liturgical and doctrinal tradition overturned in the Roman Catholic Church. In other words, they want to radicalize it and revolutionize it even more and turn it into a leveraged church to force other churches into their view. I'm thinking in particular of ordination of women to the priesthood. I'm thinking in particular of ordination of homosexuals and so on. I think this is the agenda that they want to put into place. In other words, they want to eradicate the last vestiges of any sort of cultural power or critique that various churches could exercise. And of course, the Vatican is their target. And I think the ultimate aim here, in terms of what we discussed last week, in terms of this nexus between culture and finance and economy, is they are trying, in my opinion, to position the Vatican to be one of the guarantor or participating central banks in a global currency. And by doing this, they're going to revive the old ancient practice that I talked about in Babylon's Banksters of the alliance between the bank and the temple. I think this is what their game plan is.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Vatican, you see, with the uniqueness of papal claims, and please don't get me wrong here, I never have subscribed to those claims. I never will. They're simply not historically based. They're not part of the original deposit of the faith in the Catholic tradition. But the reason why the papacy is important here is that most people don't take the time to investigate those claims in any detail. They don't know the spiritual consequence of those claims. It's kind of a cultural effect that I find very interesting. Even the Western media, when it says the Church, it's thinking Roman Catholic Church. And the papacy would be in a position to give a unique moral sanction to whatever financial system Mr. Globaloney wants to put into place. I think this is why the papacy is being so heavily targeted with, basically, to be honest, Catherine, basically with a pope and a hierarchy that no longer subscribes to any sort of traditional Roman Catholic doctrine, from what I can tell. I think this is the game plan. This is a major thing. And, of course, there will be backlash from traditional Catholics about it and so on and so forth, but I think that's the game plan.
Well, clearly there is the turmoil at the top of the Vatican is extraordinary. And every sign says to me they've got the same challenge of changing the model that we have with the U.S. federal budget.
Exactly.
In other words, whether it's the Vatican or the U.S. federal budget, they're all a prisoner of the central banking warfare model. And the war to evolve that model is turning ugly. The Midianite thing is really upon us. And it's, to me, it's one and the same.
It is one and the same for yet another reason, and I'm glad that you've mentioned this, because the Vatican Bank is, of course, kind of the central bank for the Roman Catholic Church. It's a very, very large institution. But the other thing about the Vatican Bank, of course, is that it is a papal patrimony. In other words, this is one of the key positions that the Pope has to fill with some member of the Cardinal Curiate. And it looks to me that what they're trying to do, Catherine, is to use the Vatican Bank and its status to cloak financial activity. In other words, if you think it's difficult to get federal accountability under the constitutional provisions, budgetary provisions, of where this money is going and what it's being spent for, think about the Vatican Bank, because literally anything in that bank's operation can, by order of the Pope, be hushed up. You're dealing, in other words, with a sovereign entity with even more sovereignty in a certain sense than the Bank of International Settlements.
Well, do the numbers. Just imagine
exactly.
The magic of compound interest when you don't have to pay taxes and you have diplomatic immunity for 2,000 years.
well, not 2,000.
That's a lot of real estate.
It's not 2,000. The papal claims really begin to be asserted and exercised in their modern form in the 9th century.
Right.
And there are reasons that happens. But, at least a millennium. And the problem here is, as you say, they essentially have been functioning as their own kind of very open, hidden economy, because they've exempted themselves, throughout history from secular taxation.
Well, I've always believed that the reason the Americans created the hidden system of finance after the war is to compete.
Yes.
With the Vatican's. Right.
Yes, absolutely. It's not only competition, but in a certain sense, they've had to use the Vatican in that system.
Right.
So this is the Vatican is definitely plugged into it. If you don't believe me, folks, read Malachi Martin's novel called Vatican. It's a very historically based novel, and he goes into some details in that thing that will boggle the mind in terms of the financial arrangements. But this to me is the big cultural news, and it's bad news for traditional Catholics. I'll just put it that way. And they have my sympathy. They really do.
Right. One of the things that I thought was clearly happening in the second quarter, You know, I've talked about the big question before, is are we going to be a human or inhuman society?
Yes.
And you're literally watching the Luciferian demonic culture that's
yes.
behind and in the deep state sort of come out of the closet.
Yes,
and,
absolutely.
And it's starting to dawn on many fine, respectable citizens who haven't fathomed that it's really this nuts. You know, they're
yeah.
starting to, you know, as good and evil show their faces and we're all being required to choose, they're having to say, you know, I can't avoid picking sides here because it really is this bad.
Yeah, it is. And it's only going to grow. And I'm glad that you called it Luciferian, because this is the fundamental underlying thing, I think, that is going on across the board. And we need to have a little bit of an understanding of what we mean when we say Luciferian. If you
right.
follow the standard doctrine or the standard mythology, Lucifer rebels against his own innate good nature because he's rebelling against God, and therefore becomes this horribly irrational, twisted, narcissistic, I would say cosmically narcissistic, ego. And on top of this, part of the reason for the rebellion in some traditions is the creation of man. So in other words, you have a super intelligence twisted in upon itself that has ultimately an anti-human, inhuman agenda. And if you stop and consider the profundity, it's a very simple thing, but it's also a very profound thing. This is what we're watching across the board. And I do think that, you know, whether you're atheist or not, the mythology is powerful enough to appeal to people who themselves may, you know, either be agnostic or atheistic, but nevertheless embrace the methods, so to speak, of that entity. Think of Saul Alinsky in this regard.
Right.
You know, his book, Rules for Radicals, and dedicating it to Lucifer, and then Hillary Clinton liking that book. Well, there you go. You know?
Right.
So it's a very, very important thing. I think part of the cultural problem that we face is that the West in the last 100 to 150 years has been treated to this steady diet of distancing people from any real theological literacy of the roots of this culture and how they come out of certain Christian doctrines, for good or ill. And that's helped fuel the crisis that we're in. So yeah, I'm in full agreement with you, Catherine, and you know, we could do seminars on Luciferian agendas in this culture, and hopefully someday I'll get around to writing some books about the subject.
Well, you know, we've seen articles, more and more articles about the level of homelessness rising.
Yes.
One during the second quarter, big reports about homelessness levels in Los Angeles, and I think as these things become worse, or the opioid crisis, and basically companies marketing, you know, I think it's something like, if you look at the number of opioids being, prescriptions being filled in Ohio, it's, you know, 60 per person for the
yes.
entire state, you know, impossible
yeah.
levels of opioids. So you're watching, you know, symptoms of actual humanity done to humans as the social safety net gets pulled, and the, you know, we run into these continual controlled demolitions of pension funds and other financial arrangements. I think all of these things are going to increasingly cause people to realize, look, we're going in a very inhuman direction, and that can't happen. You know, if there's $27 trillion to bail out the banks,
right.
This certainly doesn't have to be happening. One thing I would mention, I was looking, you know, because I am really concerned about Chicago, and I was looking at the numbers. Since 1990, the African-American population has dropped 200,000. Or, you know, almost 20%. Now, you know that can't happen without a real serious economic cleansing, if not genocide plan, which is,
what I believe is going on.
I keep talking about that moment in the Clinton administration when one of the political appointees said, oh, black people are hopeless, we're moving them out and bringing in the Hispanics. So I believe this was all very intentional. So the signs of inhumanity are growing. And
yes,
I just wanted to mention one other story that struck me as very important from a cultural standpoint. Uber is one of the largest private companies in the world coming out of Silicon Valley, the so-called unicorns. And it's had terrible management problems. And you have a very aggressive culture that built the company fast. But if you look at what was going on internally, it was clearly a very unprofessional and incoherent kind of culture. And there was finally a wonderful engineer who left, got another very good job, and then proceeded to write a very detailed and it wasn't revengeful in any respect. It was just simply describing why working at Uber was like working in an insane asylum. And it was written by a woman engineer, but the focus was on, I would say, was on incoherence, not so much sexism. Well, it was the last straw, and the investors and board of Uber just, had a hissy fit. Not that this is a solution to anything, brought in, Darth Vader, Eric Holder, who did a analysis or, sort of a legal analysis, and they ended up asking the CEO to take a break and then resign. And at the board meeting, after having announced this and agreed that the CEO was going to step down, David Bonderman, who has a reputation for being one of the crudest LBO guys on the planet, then proceeded to make a sexist joke. And to his shock and amazement, Arianne Huffington, who was handling this process as a board member, managed to achieve a resolution where Bonderman gets thrown off the board. Now, what that is saying to me, one possibility is political correctness has reached an unprecedented level if David Bonderman can get knocked off the board. But I would have a different interpretation, and that is that the big money investors who are investing in Uber, have had it with non-adult supervision. It's just like, behave like an adult or take your toys and go home.
Yes.
And I think that, just like the investors in Australia who were saying, look, the young people will not be our employees, the young people will not take us seriously, and that's a political problem, and we've got to care about what our impact is on the world.
Right.
And I think you're seeing this slow but steady, feedback loop from whether it's the younger generation or investors who understand if every way you make money destroys the pie, then it's going to destroy them as well. And slowly you have this feedback loop coming around and saying, if your country and your company are not under adult supervision, we're pulling our money.
Yep, absolutely. There you go. Yeah, it's part and parcel. It's a necessary step in the restoration of virtue in the culture. And when virtue is restored, the other thing that is restored with it is courtesy.
Right.
And courtesy is a habit of mind that comes out of thinking before acting or speaking in a certain way that might be insensitive to other people. In other words, it's a self-correction mechanism. It's not, you don't have to impose it from Ottawa, in these ludicrous laws. It's something that comes out of a mindset that wants to practice and cultivate virtue. So adult supervision comes out of that.
I think it's a hopeful sign that David Bonderman got booted off the board, but I think it'd be a lot more hopeful if Eric Holder got booted out of the attorney's position.
Well, yeah, it would be more helpful if he got booted out of the attorney's position than, if Jerry Brown got booted out of the governorship of California and we had some adult supervision in the legislature there. But, this is all cultural, and that's my point. We we have to get back to the fundamental institutions and traditions of this culture, be it from artistic creativity to human interaction. And, you know, the fact of the matter is this, in this country particularly, the educational system has worked counter to that for so long that literally we're going to have to start, you know, learning our cultural ABCs all over again, because most people don't even know them anymore.
So let's turn to science technology. And by science and technology, I mean real science and technology, not fake science. Speaking of virtue. So let's start with cybersecurity and zero integrity systems. We continue to plan, all of the industry continues to plan to levy their profits or levitate their profits with the Internet of Things, and yet all we have is cyber insecurity. So any new developments on that front?
Well, as I mentioned last week, we had the Chinese doing that quantum entanglement experiment between the Earth and the ground at a distance of 1,000 kilometers. Now, that's hugely significant.
Right.
Because this will enable a certain degree of cybersecurity using that method of communication of information. The problem here that I have, Catherine, is there's so much hype out there about quantum computing and quantum entanglement, and this is the one-size-fits-all solution. This is the magic wand. This will give us completely secure cyber systems forever after. You know, and I'm sorry, this reminds me too much of the gun versus armor debates back in the 19th century when, you know, they were building warships, and finally we've got the perfect armor now. There will never be another projectile able to get through our wonderful system, and then of course somebody comes along and invents a bigger cannon, you know.
Right.
But you know, this is what alarms me about this quantum computing entanglement blockchain. This whole thing seems to me to be a meme that's being very carefully driven by the powers that be to get people to be lulled into a state of security about these systems, wanting, you know, put your money here because these are going to be completely unhackable. Well, I say nonsense. Where there's a human will, there's a human way. And current theory may not be able to support it, but trust me, some human being out there is going to prove the scientists and engineers and technicians wrong. Don't fall for this. In cybersecurity, I don't care how sophisticated the system is, it's always going to be relative, and there's always going to be somebody that will figure the way around it. Even if it's as simple a thing as some insider with access to the planning of the system or the administration of the system selling the information. This is the bottom line.
So one of the great comments in the second quarter on the Salyer Report was Bill Binney saying, look, we got to teach you, you know, we've got to develop the capacity to create lots of encryption systems of our own. And if enough people do it, it'll just blow up the whole system.
Yeah, exactly.
right.
Exactly.
One of the things that it's always important to count your blessings. And I think one thing that's having a very profound impact on the economy without which we would all be infinitely worse off, and that is we're seeing very dramatic drops in the energy prices. And I attribute a lot of that, you know, obviously geopolitics is a part of it, but I attribute a lot of it to a whole range of technological changes, from fracking technology on fossil fuels to much greater efficiency to renewables, as well as the battery technology, breakthrough energy technology, and then, of course, just communication technology, making it possible to do more with information and less with energy, whatever the source. So it's an explosion of different technologies, but clearly we have a deflating energy price, and it's making an enormous... Imagine if our gas prices were two or three times higher than they are now. What would be going on politically?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely correct to stress the cumulative effect of different technologies on energy prices, particularly, and I'm very grateful that you stress the idea of information, because let's back up and think about 30 years ago before the World Wide Web really got things off and running. If you wanted to shop for a book that you were looking for or buy a particular ingredient for a recipe, what did you have to do? Well, to get the recipe, you had to go out and buy the cookbook, or at best, watch a television show where the recipe was given, and then you had to go out and buy the ingredients. Now you don't have to do that. You can sit at home and buy the ingredients online. So you're absolutely correct here. The technologies are having a cumulative effect on driving the energy prices down. This is not simply Saudi Arabia flooding the market with oil to crash the American fracking system and the Russian energy system. It's not that. This is a permanent trend. The other thing you mentioned is alternative energy sources. I just blogged about this, as a matter of fact, about, you know, cars that run on natural gas. We don't even need to talk about self-driving cars or electronic freeways. This stuff has been around a long time. I think it's going to increase dramatically.
Right.
And then finally, we have, you know, the persistent stories about, I just saw another one today, that NASA has successfully concluded a bunch of experiments with plasma engines, learning how to control the magnetic field and therefore manipulate the plasma in the engine to steer it.
Wow.
Essentially, yeah, this is a huge development. So, yeah, these things are happening, and, you know, one thing it does signal, it signals the end, and I think this is good news in a certain sense. It signals the end of the radical Islamic states like Saudi Arabia having a monopoly over everybody else's energy supply.
Right.
In the short term, however, the geopolitical consequence of this is that those states might be turned, like the empire, to war as the solution for the difficulties that they're in.
Right.
And, you know, the only other way out of this is for them to learn how to make things that the rest of the world wants. And that in turn, will inevitably clash with some of their fundamentalist dogmas. So we're watching a period of transition, I think, because of all of these developments in the Middle East. It's going to be very, very delicate. Now, one thing that is very interesting is you look at the Saudis. There does appear to be a certain segment within the Saudi royal family that realizes it's facing all these problems and they've got to do something about it.
Well, look at bringing up a 31-year-old essentially to run the country. I mean, it's an extraordinary shift.
Yeah, right. People don't realize that is a huge shift. And you know, I bash the Saudis a lot. I'll be very honest. I call them the outhouse of Saud and so on and so forth on my website. But yeah, if you step back from the rhetoric for a moment and look at what is going on internally in that country, you know, offering Aramco shares publicly and so on, promoting this prince, it does appear that there is at least a kind of a begrudging admission that there has to be a strategic change of direction. Now, whether or not he and that group will be able to pull it off is another matter, but it does have huge geopolitical consequences, Catherine, because, number one, they've got to pull it off, and they won't be able to pull it off, you know, by being constantly at war. So this is a long-term geopolitical development in that region of the world, I think, has to be watched very carefully.
Right.
The same thing, I think you're seeing kind of the same thing with Erdogan. I saw an interesting article recently of Erdogan with a picture of him dressed, I kid you not, I was just floored, dressed in the imperial robes of an Ottoman sultan. And I was just dumbfounded, and I had to stop and think, well, what is that presage? What's the message he's really trying to say there? And I think, again, his message there is cultural. He's wanting to get back to a period within that culture where there was a high type of civilization, which the Ottomans for a particular period embodied, and this is what he's trying to hold out to the Turks as something rather different than the course that they were on, you know, the secularizing, westernizing, Mr. Globaloney course. And at the same time, I don't think he wants to steer Turkey back into all of the bad habits that led to the demise of the Ottoman Empire. I think it's kind of a cultural reminder message that he's trying to send. So there's lots of things going on culturally that are having this huge geopolitical impact, and I think it's going.
Right.
I think in the long term, I think you're going to see. I've said for many years that I think the Islamic world is being set up for a fall, and don't get me wrong, I'm no friend to the tenets of that ideology, but by the same token, you know, you're dealing with 1 billion people, and not all of them are clamoring to get onto our shores and cut our heads off.
Right.
I think you're going to see a major change in that part of the world, particularly as they address some of their own internal problems and do so in a way that tries to help them keep pace with what China wants to do and embark
right.
upon. They have to, Catherine. They just simply have to.
If I had a source of information that, you know, if the genie came out of the bottle and I could get a reliable source of information on any topic within science and technology, what I would want is excellent information on invisible weaponry, including space weaponry.
Yes.
And one of the things I want to point out in the second quarter is we now see a proposal bouncing around Congress to create a new branch of the military called the Space Corps. As
yep.
a separate military service within the Department of the Air Force. Now,
yep.
if it's under the Air Force, from a budgetary standpoint, I think it's still going to be under the Navy. But that's a big development, and because I think, to me, if the unipolar empire is betting on anything, it's space weaponry. And
yes.
that's why the Chinese putting up these quantum computing satellites is so important. Because if they're going to... If they're going to compete with space weaponry, they're going to have...
Well, it's the other reason that you see the Chinese a few years ago launching their anti-satellite missile from the ground to destroy an old, obsolete Chinese satellite. That was a huge
right. yes.
technological achievement, and it was also a huge message. And
yes.
it's the other side of the coin, Catherine, to what we mentioned last week when I was talking about the Russian electromagnetic communications interference technology, the Donald Cook incident, the USS Fitzgerald, which I strongly suspect has a Russian and or Chinese hand in it. What they're doing is they're demonstrating capabilities that are directly applicable in space. Now, the U.S., I think you're absolutely correct that in opening up a department of the military that essentially ultimately looks like it's being positioned to be its own independent service branch, much like the Coast Guard, the Navy, the Air Force, and so on. This is what it looks to me that they're doing. Now, the real question is, what are they really saying here? And I suspect that the message, as you've mentioned, is not only that they want to develop and deploy space-based weapons. I suspect they also want to deploy human-based anti-satellite troops. In other words, troops that will be able to depart from the ground here on Earth, fly up, take out a satellite, or put bugs on satellites that only a human
right.
being currently can do. This is what I suspect they're doing.
Right.
And, of course, under that activity, you can cloak other activities like kidnapping people and flying them to moon bases or Mars bases and so on and so forth. You know, that's getting way out there, but since we're speculating... And projecting the future, that's what we need to do.
Well, what astonishes me is the extent to which they keep all this stuff secret. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And but I really wonder how much longer, given what the growth. It's one area where the employment growth is going to be happening.
Oh, yeah.
if you look at the web presentation for the second quarter wrap-up, we've been updating our lists of space companies. And, you know, the lists of companies that are doing things in space are just exploding. And you can see there's tremendous activity. And, you, of course, you wouldn't notice it when you're too busy listening to how the Russians interfered with the U.S. election.
I know.
Okay, before we go on to Go Local, anything else in science and technology? What to you was the big event in the second quarter in science and technology?
Well, to me, the big event was that Chinese quantum computing. That to me was the big story.
Yeah, and if you look at everything they're doing to build out financial liquidity, including, you know, for the 20th anniversary celebration, they sailed the aircraft carrier into Hong Kong, and you know, but getting control of the sea lanes in the South China Sea is all part of that. Okay, so let's turn to Go Local, because you and I both know one of the ways to offset the centralization is to just move more time, attention, resources locally. And I really am finally enthusiastic about seeing, you know, I'm seeing so many people get the opportunity and say, oh, wait, you know, why am I wasting all this time on, you know, watching the presidential election? I need to pay attention locally. So I kind of see it happening. And we had a great Solera report on unpacking your financial ecosystem. I've seen a lot more interest in taking the time to understand how the money works, including the federal money in your congressional district or locally. I put up a great book review for a book called Follow the Money, A Citizen's Guide to Local Government. So we're trying to make more resources accessible, but I'd be very interested to hear you say what you see on the going local front among your members.
Well, from my members, I'm getting kind of the same story, the same trend that you're seeing. I think that people are gradually waking up to the fact that they can do a great deal of things locally, and in the process, they can decouple more and more from this all-consuming centralizing system. In fact, you know, I think we're at the stage now where we need detailed sort of strategic guides on how to decouple. And, you know, we've mentioned a couple of them in last week's first part. Namely, if your investment strategy includes investing locally, be it your time, your money, what have you, the first thing to find out is any institution that you're going to be working with exposed to your central government, and if so, to what extent is it exposed? And then on that basis, do you really want to work with it or not? It's like what you said is going on in Australia with the young people saying, I don't want to work for your corporation. You're just not, you know, you're just not responsible. So that's right. The strategy, you know, that's the basic principle I think that we need to put into place, not just with our you know, where we bank. We've talked about banking locally
You want to get the take on your life, right? And you want to not deal with people and institutions that have, you know, serious conflicts of interest.
Yes, so, absolutely.
Right. So it's all I call it coming clean. And we have over in the constitutional section, we have a whole section on how we can enforce the Constitution, and it includes just endless ideas on this topic, and ones that I'm going to want to engage you on when you have a chance to read it. So, because the big one, of course, is how are we going to, we have in that list your great idea about let's give more budget to the attorney generals and get them to sue the federal government and back those federal mandates right out of our lives.
Right. Yeah, we discussed that in the first quarter. And the other thing I think that we need to be thinking of down the line, particularly in this country, since we've got yet another seemingly our endless election cycles, we've got another cycle coming up. And I think people need to, you know, again, thinking of acting locally, is draw up letters, lists of questions of a constitutional nature, about the budget, how to enforce it, and so on and so forth, and start nailing it to every single start a campaign.
Oh, I would.
Get as many people, mail over and over and over, bombard these people with the same letters demanding a public answer, and posting, if you've got a private website or a Facebook page, posting the fact that they refused to answer my question, did not answer my question, evaded the whatever, and hold these politicians' feet to the fire.
Right. Over in the constitutional section, I have several letters that I've written to Congress, both my congressmen and other congressmen who, were abdicating their responsibility in terms of the missing money and money being stolen from the federal government. So all those letters are over there, and you can use them. We encourage you to send them and use them. And there's, I have that great video of Cynthia McKinney grilling Rumsfeld.
Right.
Don't say that nobody's been doing anything, because she risked her life to do that and did a great job of it. Anyway, so there are tremendous things you can do. Okay, anything else on Go Local before we turn to the unanswered questions?
I think that pretty well covers it. I think we've talked about some of these ideas before, and that's just kind of a good recapitulation.
Well, it gets down to actionable intelligence, and I think what each one of us has to do is look at both our own circumstances, our own life, and say, okay, my free and inspired life, which is the piece for me locally that is energizing for me to pick up and do? You've got to find the piece that's energizing for you. Everybody's different. It's just chock full of nuts ideas in this second quarter wrap-up on the web presentation under Constitution. Okay, unanswered questions. Now, we've talked about what in the world's going on in Antarctica, what in the world's going on in space, where is all the missing money going? What's the big unanswered question in your mind this quarter?
Oh boy, in terms of finances, I'm with you. We need to get a handle on where the missing money is.
Yep.
The other big unanswered question for me is a very different one, and you kind of hint at it up here with the first two articles. New pyramid built 3,700 years ago, discovered in Egypt, atmospheric study and gravity waves. I've been noticing, I don't know about you, and perhaps the listeners as well have been noticing, a trend of more and more weird stories like this coming out. Another recent one was they just discovered that maybe humans were mating with Neanderthals as long as 450,000 years ago. And I read this article, Catherine, and my first thought was, well, wait a minute, according to the standard model, modern man wasn't even around 450,000 years ago, much less to be mating, male or female with Neanderthals. So, there's more and more of these stories coming out. And I have to view this whole thing whole. We've got missing money. We've got, you put up the article 9/11. We've got atmospheric study and gravity waves, of all things, new pyramids and so on and so forth. What viewing this whole tells me, and I've been doing this kind of crazy wackadoodle high-octane speculation research now since 2001, the more I do it, the more I'm convinced of one overall overriding thing, and that is virtually every standard academic paradigm, from financial analysis to ancient history, is under severe assault, and it's breaking down.
Right. Right.
Because more and more of these stories, Catherine, I'm almost breathless every week in the articles that people send me. More and more of these paradigms are breaking down to the point that now you get the major media even starting to talk about these stories. To me, this is very encouraging, because what it means is that the professional classes, the monopolies, let's just be honest, that's what they are, the monopolies and trusts that have appointed themselves as gatekeepers of the narrative, these people are quickly losing power, and ultimately they're going to lose their job.
Right.
To me, this is very encouraging because it means that under the right conditions, if these trends continue, you could have an explosion of artistic and scientific and literary creativity like we've never seen before.
Well, you know, that's true because I can't tell you, just in the last 6 months, I have met so many subscribers who've, you know, who've kind of hit the trance, gotten out of the trance, found the Solari right. Report, found your writings, or they all read your books, and they start to move into 26 tracks, and the first thing that happens is sort of shock and grief and transition, and then they kind of get into the flow of like, wow, it's a much more complicated, richer world, and there's all these opportunities, and then suddenly, you know, something happens. They blossom. And
yep.
Think of millions and millions of people blossoming.
Yes.
It's quite remarkable, yeah.
It is.
And that's why it's so much fun when I see them meet each other, because then they just start, you know, the creativity flows. Right, and,
yep.
And suddenly they start realizing, oh, you know, if we can play with each other on 26 tracks, imagine what could happen here.
Bingo. And,
right.
You know, and not only play with each other on 26 tracks, but keep it harmonically coherent.
Right, right.
That's the key,
right.
You know, and, you know, I'm going to give people a big hint here. That idea did not come out of any other culture. There are certain specific metaphysical reasons why that whole 26-track harmonic coherence comes out of Western culture.
Right.
There are conceptual links galore, if you want to think about it. And
right.
this is exploding. You know, even the fact that we get articles like what you've put up here under the unanswered questions, and, you know, we could put gobs more articles like this up
right.
here. The very fact that articles like this are appearing at all is an indicator that the explosion's taking place, because you've got people going out and finding this stuff and saying, oh, look at this. So this is not going to stop. It's going to continue, and I think ultimately it spells the end of the narrative trusts, you know, the monopolies
right.
of academic narratives, and that's good. It's healthy. You don't need to agree
right.
with alternative narratives, but at least admit that they're there and that they have an argument behind them, and that these are not silly people that are completely irrational sporting a silly conspiracy theory. That's not it at all.
Right. Well, there are two messages I hear everywhere I go all over the world, and that is mm-hmm. whatever the new model is, or new it's really new models. It's not one model. It's new
right.
models. They all have to operate on 26 tracks.
Yep.
And they all have to respect, you know, sort of the return to myself and the return to the other. So there has to be reciprocity, whether it's, you know, for the opportunity or the risk management. And it has to function on 26 tracks. And it has to be able to deal with my complexity and your complexity. And that's a lot of complexity, but that's the way it is.
That's the way it is. That's right.
Yeah. That's the way it is. Well, I would say this. To me, just because of the time we're coming into politically, we have to me, the unanswered question right now is, where is the money? Because whether it's the Midianite thing going on at the Vatican or the Midianite thing going on in Congress, you know, and we should mention, because I haven't mentioned Scalise being shot, which I
right.
suspect has to do with NSA authorizations and some of the other dicey issues. But if you look at the Midianite thing going on in these big institutions dealing with how do we change the model, the only way we can get an evolution of the model in a positive direction is if we bring transparency to the issue of the hidden systems of finance, whether it's
yes.
at the Vatican or the U.S. budget. You've got to, you know, I used to have a wonderful colleague who was also digging in and looking for the corruption that happened around the black budget. And he used to, when he got really frustrated, he used to say, his accent wasn't very good, he used to say, "Ooh, est la dinero."
Yes. Well, you know, you mentioned Scalise here, the congressman that was shot during that rampage. And Catherine, I think you're right. I think this is not only NSA connected, but I think it's connected to the whole thing going on with the Vatican and everything else that we've seen.
Right.
Because he was also, if my memory serves me correctly, sponsoring a bill to deal with these child sex, you know, human child sex trafficking rings, whatever
right.
you want to call them. He was involved with that. So I definitely view that whole thing is connected to everything else and yet another hit against transparency and someone that wanted to
right.
do something about it.
Right. Well, on a number of fronts, you know, because the House caucus is also moving to limit the war powers authorization that got into place after 2001.
Yeah.
So whether it's the war power authorization or bulk collection by the NSA and ratcheting back those authorizations or human trafficking, you know, there's no doubt that Scalise was getting serious about, I hate to say this, enforcing the Constitution. So, which is a good sign, but it'll show you how dangerous it is for a congressman to do the right thing and why it's essential that we support the ones who do and try and find ways to help protect them. Okay, well, let's turn to inspiration because there was a lot that happened in the second quarter that was very inspiring for me. One of which, of course, was the lunch in May in Louisville, Kentucky, to celebrate the successful raising of the Phase 1 and Phase 2 crowd fund. And I get to say it, Joseph, I told you so.
Yeah, you did. I didn't expect any of that to happen. Nearly. I was thinking, you were thinking in terms of months, and I was thinking in terms of decades.
I think there is so much support for your work, and I get to see it because I'm bopping around talking to lots of people, and you don't do that as much. But it was for me a way of communicating to you the support that is there, and I'm hoping that it's accomplished that.
Well, I want to thank you and everybody again because that, you know, it's a dream come true for me. I've been without it for so long, and I do miss it. And Well, you know, something that's very interesting that's happened as a result of it is I have been thinking in some detail and writing in private notebooks about culture and aesthetics and you know, aesthetic philosophy and things like that in connection to music. And it's kind of helping focus things in other areas that I do talk about publicly. So it's had a very weird sort of it's personally and privately reaffirming, but in such a way that it's beginning to spill over. I don't know if that makes any
right.
sense.
Yeah, yeah, no, it makes it makes total sense because I think that's what happens when you know, part of what I call the free and inspired life is once you move to the 26 tracks, that's what happens.
Right.
You gave a speech that was marvelous and provided the text to us that's up on the crowdfund website that you can link to from Giza Death Star or from Soleri. And I would really encourage people to read it. It's quite remarkable and was... I would say the audience was quite inspired. And that speech was one of the most inspiring things I heard during the second quarter, hands down.
Oh, thank you.
Well, check it out. It's quite marvelous. The other thing I have to say, one of the links under inspiration on the News, Trends, and Story part of the website is I did an interview in... with Bloomberg for the Daybreak Asia radio show when I was in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And I had visited, I did two visits. I went to visit the Chinese University, which
right.
is where I did my third year abroad. And wow, it was, I was just blown away by what they are doing and what they've achieved. I wrote a commentary about it and you can read more about it. And I was shown around by one of the professors who's really a remarkable individual, and it's a remarkable institution. And then I went to visit a huge new monastery that's been built in Hong Kong that's absolutely beautiful. And then, but one of the things that came out as I went around and got a chance to do these various things and talk with our subscribers in Hong Kong is you realize that the young people of Hong Kong are really struggling both with the sort of oligarchy nature of the economy, but also the sort of central control coming in from China as China gets more and more present, the PRC government gets more and more present, and their concern, you know, you get a sense from the young people that they're not as excited about their future, which is essential if Hong Kong is going to reinvent itself. You know, Hong Kong is a city that's reinvented itself many times, and one of the things you felt, I did my third year abroad there in 1970-71, the young people, Joseph, were so excited about their future, and you know, Hong Kong was really the super connector to the world for that whole area and for China, and they played a critical role in it. When I was in Australia, the young people are very excited about their future. When I was in, and they're just doing, they're rocking and rolling and creating companies and building apps and doing all sorts of things. And then when I was in Bangladesh, it was the same thing. You had this remarkable group of kids from all over Asia, and they're just doing and, you know, scheming and conspiring and excited about their future. And
the sadness, safe spaces.
Right. And the sadness of the kids in the United States and the sadness of the kids in Hong Kong made me realize, oh, you know, when you take away the power of your kids to build an exciting future, then you know, that is the end of the future itself. And I really came back from Asia saying, what can I do to help create, you know, to put the tools into the hands of the young people so that they can really go off and build, you know, the free, inspired future that they dream of. So what can I do? And I think so that, you know, seeing the young people inspired about their future in Australia and in Bangladesh, and seeing how it contrasted to the United States and Hong Kong really reminded me we cannot let the centralizers destroy our children's vision of an inspired future. We can't let that happen.
No, we can't. And you know, you said it earlier, we need not only to start shunning these people, we need to start taking the gloves off with their status as heroes. We need, you know, we need to point out that these super rich people are basically stupid parasites. They may live in mansions, they may go to the opera, but they don't understand any of it from a real passionate investment of their own emotion in it. It's just, you know, they do it because that's what the rich do. That's what they think.
Well, but so let me make a plug for some of the rich, because I know lots of people, and I've known lots of people all my life who got rich because they do great stuff.
Right.
You know, exactly. They go off, they build a bit. I mean, I have clients who have family businesses. They went off, they did something
they
great, they worked
things.
Their butt off. They build things.
Right.
And so I make a complete, you know, to me, somebody, an entrepreneur who builds a great company or his family builds a great company is totally different than somebody who uses government money and central banking tricks to rig profits into their, you know. So to me, there's a difference between true entrepreneurs and rent seekers, and I think it's hard for people to tell the difference, but we're going to have to be able to make a difference because, you know, here's the question. Do I get rich by increasing the total economic return or decreasing it? And that's what I heard in Australia. The kids are saying, if you don't make your money from increasing the total economic return, boy, you know, we want nothing to do with you.
Well, this is, you know, I probably should have clarified, you know, when I say super rich, I don't mean the entrepreneurial people that go out and create a business, employ people, and make stuff, you know.
Right.
I mean the parasitic finance capital class, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, that, you know, basically make money by clipping coupons and selling paper to each other.
Right, and telling their covert ops to go kill somebody.
Yeah, and precisely, you know, this is the group of people that need exposure Their lives, you know, what they've done in their life needs exposure and commentary and so on. You know, David Rockefeller writes a memoir where he boasts about, you know, being Mr. Global and having committed treason.
Right.
And, you know, to me, that's actionable legally. You know, where were the U.S. attorneys to haul his, you know what, into court to answer for?
Yeah, especially when he's doing it with my money.
Especially when he's doing it with my money, which he thinks is his money, which he's getting because of special arrangements with the government. No, these people are a parasite class, and they need to be exposed. I have nothing against the entrepreneur that makes a product and sells it and makes a living that way, unless they start getting too big for their britches and want to buy, you know, retail grocery stores and connect it to the CIA database that they have built up. You know? That's when I start having a problem with them.
And publish fake news with the Washington Post.
And publish
fake news for all we know,
Bezos was right?
Yeah, Bezos was told he had to do that or else they'd come and get him.
It's the Chuck Schumer problem.
You have to do what the intelligence agencies tell you to do. Well, here's the thing. I think that the message to me from the second quarter, and I'm going to start using this as a quote, it's from Dr. Joseph Farrell, the time has come to take the gloves off.
Yeah.
The time has come. We have something very, very wonderful and special, and the time has come to fight for it. So.
Yep, absolutely.
That's what we're going to do, and it's going to make the third quarter even more interesting. I'm looking for inspiration because I cannot wait for you for the virtual pipe organ to be delivered, which I think is going to come in the third quarter. Now, we have another phase that we're still raising capital for, but it can be installed after you have that big, beautiful organ at your house. So I'm waiting for the inspiration.
I have a confession. I've been writing a book. I started writing a book about 2 weeks ago. I'm writing a book. It's a book mostly for me. It's a book I knew I'd have to write. But I came across some information, and I just decided, I've got to write this book just to get it down, even if the book doesn't make any sense. But anyway, I'm writing this book, and I'm scrambling to get this dang thing done because I don't want to have it not finished when that thing comes, because I know what's going to happen when that thing comes. I'm going to be like a kid in a candy store. So anyway, I'm scrambling to get this book done.
Here's the question. Can you play it late at night without keeping your neighbors up?
When the guy comes to voice it, one of the things I want him to do is, you know, put the combinations on and put it on full organ and open up the expression, and then I'm going to shut the door, keep the windows down, and walk around and listen and see how much leaks out.
We may have to do a phase four to insulate your house.
I don't think it's going to be that bad, but you know, I'm going to have to do it just to be on the safe side.
You have a pretty big yard, so I think it'll be okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to a third quarter. I can't thank you enough for your presence in my life and in all of our lives. You make a huge difference.
Well, thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
And
especially for all the hard work on the virtual pipe organ.
They'll never put our minds in a corner when you're around. So, okay, well, Joseph, you have a wonderful evening, and we look forward to doing the news, trends, and stories for the third quarter. It's going to be a very interesting third quarter, and definitely keep us posted. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Catherine. You too.
Have a great day. Bye.
Yep. You too.